This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, jails are designed to be secure, not deadly. But in some parts of the country, people are dying at alarming rates. In Louisville, 10 have died since last November. Today on 1A, a closer look at what's led to these deaths and the nationwide struggle to improve care for those in custody. That's coming up today at 6. Now, in a speech 1 week ago in Philadelphia, President Joe Biden outlined threats to democracy, including former President Trump, saying that Trump and extremist Republicans, he said, are seeking to dismantle America's democratic institutions and operations. Our next guest says there is a real threat, and he says the underlying causes of that threat started long before Donald Trump ran for president. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 1 week out. What do you think of President Biden's speech about threats to representative government in the United States? Did you follow the response from former President Trump? Do you worry about the future of elected government in the United States, about the risk of authoritarianism? Call in with your thoughts or questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Darrell West is Vice President of Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for Tech Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He previously taught political science and public policy at Brown University. His new book is called Power Politics: Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Darrell, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Your second chapter is all about why to be worried. Some people might think, okay, yeah, we did have an attempt to overturn the presidential election of 2020. We had the January 6th attack on the Capitol. We got through. We survived. We were tested, and we did okay. Why should they still be worried?
We still should be worried because we're facing a perfect storm of threats to American democracy. It's not just the things you mentioned, which, of course, are very problematic in their own right, but we're seeing restrictions on voting rights, poor institutional performance, a toxic information ecosystem, the use and threats of political violence. But the real problem is we're not solving the basic problems facing our country. You know, income inequality is at a 100-year high. There's a loss of economic opportunity. There are all these culture wars. People are really frustrated with our system. When they're not doing well, they look for scapegoats. They turn to unconventional leaders, and we start to see people like Trump come forward.
You've got Trump in your subtitle, but you make a very big point that these problems that you just listed, and we'll dig more into them, these problems have been around for years. They won't go away even if Donald Trump retired from politics.
Polarization, extremism, and radicalization have emerged over several decades. And I do make the argument in the book that Trumpism is going to outlast Trump. Even if somehow magically Donald Trump retired tomorrow and never made another public utterance on issues of national controversy, Trumpism would still be there. The factors that enable populism and ultranationalism are still going to be there. The problems are really systemic in nature. Trump certainly has made the situation far more dangerous and more risky, but even if he disappeared, the problems would still be there.
One of the alarming statistics you cite is a growing interest in something other than representative government in the United States, people being open to the idea that maybe some sort of authoritarian government would be preferable to our system. Not a majority, but a growing number. What do you see? What do you make of that?
This is one of the things that actually shocked me the most when I was doing the research leading up to the book. I have a chapter on public opinion, and there have been several surveys over the past few years about the rise of authoritarian attitudes. And the exact number varies from survey to survey, but anywhere from a quarter to a third of Americans are willing to embrace undemocratic means. And ironically, young people actually are more likely to embrace non-democratic means. They're so worried about the opposition, like Republicans are worried that all Democrats are communists or socialists. Biden, of course, referred to his conservative rivals last week as semi-fascist. When people demonize the opposition in that particular way, they are willing to use whatever means possible to gain political power and to use political power once they have it and to keep the other side from coming to power. And unfortunately, this includes authoritarian means, the use of violence, overturning a popular rule. Like there are states that have basically enabled their state legislatures to decide which set of party electors get sent to Congress as part of the Electoral College. There's a lot of worrisome trends developing in public opinion that could turn the United States towards a much more authoritarian government.
You also point toward a concern about minority control of the government. Are institutions not representing people well? I'm going to quote here. One of the preconditions to an effective representative government, you say, quote, is fair representation in political institutions and some correspondence between public opinion and public policy, as long as the policy does not endanger basic rights. Institutionally, what are the threats to that?
Yes, and I should clarify that when we say minority rule, we mean rule by political minorities. So we're obviously not talking about racial minorities here, but there's a loss of majority control in the sense that if you look at House elections because of gerrymandering, like I think Democrats are going to have to win by almost 53-47% to regain or keep a majority control of the House. In the Electoral College, obviously, we don't have direct popular voting. One statistic that I discovered in doing research for the book was that if you look at all the presidential elections, 1992 through 2020, Republicans won the presidential popular vote only once. That was in 2004 when Bush beat Kerry. In every other year, Democrats have won the popular vote and then won the Electoral College and become president, or they've won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College and the Republican has become president. And so what this means is, even though Republicans have basically lost almost every presidential election over the last 30 years in the popular vote, they've actually controlled the presidency about 40% of the time. They're dominating national policymaking because of the filibuster a threat in the U.S. Senate and the need to get 60 out of 100 votes to pass basic legislation, it's hard for Democrats, even when there's a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate, to pass legislation. There are lots of pieces of legislation that are supported by 60 or 70% of Americans that are not being enacted by the U.S. Congress. So it's really the loss of majority rule that is very problematic. Threats to representative democracy, and just the fact that our system is just not functioning very well.
Talking to Darrell West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jacob starts us off in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. I'm really scared. I think that so many of the courts are stacked. So many of the state legislatures are stacked. We've got Republicans and libertarians in so many places of power in the country. Look at the last elections that have been happening across the states. There are so many people that believe what the rabid individuals on Fox News tell them, and the stuff online that is ridiculously just absurd. The conspiracy theories like QAnon, and it just makes me really worried, because I don't think people are thinking for themselves.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Darrell, Jacob brings up, let's go after his second point there, your concerns about misinformation and conspiracy theories.
Jacobs is exactly right. There is so much misinformation out there, and people are believing it. Obviously, we've seen the surveys where 70 or 80% of Republicans still think the 2020 election was stolen from them. We have anti-vaxxers, anti-mask people, climate change deniers. Like, for an era that is as scientifically and technologically developed as this one is, there's a surprising amount of misinformation and disinformation that's having real consequences. It's having public health consequences in terms of COVID, and then it's affecting our political system, because if people think the last election was stolen, it makes them more willing to think about doing unconventional things that could overturn majority rule in the 2024 presidential election. So there's been this steady erosion of facts in our process. People are developing their own facts, kind of regardless of the scientific evidence. And it just creates an information ecosystem that is incredibly toxic and dysfunctional.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I do find it ironic that your guest is talking about toxicity while he's providing nothing but talking points from the left. If we look at this objectively, what we're seeing is that we see people on the left, such as your guest, who point to people who view situations differently, and they view them as equal, evil or stupid. There's actually a lot of nuance to every single one of the points the guest made. We don't have time to go through them. And if you want to talk about what the issues are, we have a media who won't call this out. That is the problem, why the biggest threat to our democracy is a media that allows someone like this to put something out there that is so toxic without challenging back.
Steve, thanks for the call. Daryl?
Well, Steve will be pleased, I believe, by the fact that in the book, I actually condemn extremism on both sides. There are left-wing authoritarians out there that exist in American society, and there are right-wing authoritarians. But if you actually look at the public opinion evidence right now, there's a lot more right-wing authoritarians than left-wing by about a 4 or 5 to 1 margin. So I actually do worry more about right-wing authoritarianism, but it's because of the public opinion evidence. The fact that there's a lot more of them right now, it's skewing the process. The threats of violence, the domestic terrorism that we're seeing in many places around represent real threats to the process. So I try and analyze the situation as it has emerged over the last 40 years, think about what the risks are right now. And there are times where the left has certainly been guilty of lots of abuses. In the book, I do talk about social media problems. Twitter is actually dominated by liberals. And of course, it is a cesspool of falsehoods and so on. So Steve is right that there are problems on both sides, but some of the particular threats that we see to American democracy right now are actually much stronger on the right than the left.
Talking to Daryl West from the Brookings Institution about his new book. It's called Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns? Do you worry about the U.S. sliding to an ever less representative government, maybe into some form of authoritarianism? Do you have solutions, changes you'd like to see in laws, in the way we interact with each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Daryl West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the future of representative government in the United States? What are those concerns? Do you have solutions you would like to see enacted here in Wisconsin, in the nation's capital, in the way we interact with each other in person and online? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daryl, I want to talk to you about some of the solutions you offer in your book. One of them has to do with changing laws that you worry open the door to, you call them legal coups. First of all, what are the doors you want to close up and what kind of changes do we need?
Well, you know, when people think about authoritarianism, they're worried about military coups and tanks rolling through the streets. I'm actually not worried about that. I don't think that is the real threat that American democracy faces. But in the book, I do talk about legal coups. One of the things that Trump did in 2020 was to find and reveal many of the vagueness and the vulnerabilities of the way we count votes, the way our elections are conducted. And so we need to clean up the vote process as well as the vote counting process. There are laws on the books that are very problematic. Many Americans don't realize that over the last few decades, Congress has passed a lot of emergency power declarations in a variety of different areas, which basically allowed the president unilaterally to declare a state of emergency in a particular area and basically to rule unilaterally. For example, if there's a border crisis, a president could declare that a state of national emergency and basically make decisions affecting the border without going through Congress. I find this very scary and very worrisome. Obviously, when Congress passed those laws, they assumed a president would basically be a responsible and trustworthy individual, we now know that's not always going to be the case. So one remedy is Congress needs to start closing some of those loopholes. They at least should add an ability for Congress to override a presidential declaration of a national emergency, just so we're not dependent on one individual. There's been a lot of attention to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which basically governs how contested elections are resolved, how the votes are counted, the role the state legislatures play, and so on. There's a lot of vagueness, you know, the role of the vice president. You know, Trump tried to get Pence to unilaterally overturn the popular vote. Pence, to his credit, did not do that. But all those vaguenesses are still there. Congress has been debating reforms of that, and I pray that they actually do enact meaningful changes. But, you know, it's now 2 years after that election, we still have not seen any reforms of the Electoral Count Act.
In a sense, that's easy in the sense that we could pass a law to fix those. Another problem you point to seems harder to do. A lot of the motivation for candidates, you write, politicians and candidates for office, is to anger their followers and appeal to anger and extremism, whatever side they're on. How do you change that incentive structure?
You're right that there are many appeals to fear, anger, and anxiety, and that drives a lot of the toxicity in American politics these days. And, you know, it's hard to change candidate behavior, and it's hard to change voter beliefs. But the whole point about political institutions is they are supposed to take the rough edges off of politics. They are supposed to act as a filter on extremism. Our current institutions and our current electoral arrangements are not doing that. And so we need some basic election reforms. One example is ranked choice voting, which we saw in the New York City race actually produced Eric Adams, who was among the more moderate of the Democratic candidates. We saw that in Alaska, where Sarah Palin was favored to win a House seat in a state that's pretty conservative because of ranked choice voting. She did not win at that election. So it's not like we need to suddenly have our politicians acting responsibly, but if they work within institutions that basically encourage moderation and discourage extremism, then we're going to see fewer motivations to play to the extremes, and we will see more of a focus on problem solving and actually getting things done.
Talking to Darrell West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in DeForest. Nick, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
So, you know, your guest speaker talks a lot about, you know, the disconnect and it having to be with the Republican side. And I feel that a lot of things have evolved from, you know, the whole stuff with Trump having classified information, and we want to make sure that we hold him accountable for that, right? And I agree 100%. Anybody that's in office that misuses their power or authority should definitely be held accountable. But to relate back to then, you know, Hillary Clinton at the time, we need to have fair across the field. So if one candidate or one representative is doing something wrong, there needs to be accountability across the field, and that's not happening. And the big thing, too, now going into, like, you're going into election season, corporations shouldn't have a say or be a major supporter of our electives. That's something that has definitely, you know, taken our elective politicians or whoever that are running for these positions out of the...
I gotcha, Nick. We just have a couple minutes. You brought up a couple big points there, and I want to give Darrell a crack at both of them. First of all, Nick says we need accountability when people break the rules or the laws, no matter what party they're from.
I would agree 100% with Nick, but I would make the argument that Hillary Clinton, for all of her indiscretions, what she did pales in comparison to what Trump has done. In taking the classified documents that he did to Mar-a-Lago, like documents that describe our human source intelligence agents around the world. There have been stories about the nuclear capabilities of various countries, and he took documents like that. That is far more serious, far more threatening to national security than missing emails that Hillary was associated with. So we need to basically make sure the punishment, if there ends up being punishment, fits the level of the crime.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Nick also brought up, Daryl, money in politics, corporations getting involved in politics in particular.
And again, Nick is completely right on that. Money in politics is a huge problem. I mean, in terms of income inequality, you have to go back 100 years to find inequality as much as what we have now. That inequality creates two very different, but both very important problems. One is on the wealth side, that wealthy people and wealthy corporations are trying to convert economic power into political power. And that's very abusive, and they're abusing their corporate power when they do that. But it also creates a problem at the other end in terms of working class people, the loss of the American dream, and the loss of economic opportunity. One of the things that is really fueling populism and ultranationalism is the fact that wages for ordinary people have stagnated for almost 40 years now. When people are not doing well, when they think their children are going to do a lot worse than they themselves did, they're going to look for scapegoats. Trump was very good at playing that game, pinpointing particular scapegoats, immigrants, minorities, women, and so on. That introduces kind of this zero-sum element into our political process that becomes very dysfunctional.
Thanks for that call. And Daryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for Tech Innovation at the Brookings Institution. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy, and what he thinks can be done to protect representative government here in the United States. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a two-year investigation into the e-cigarette company Juul and its influence on teen vaping has ultimately led to more than $400 million in settlement money. We'll talk about the teen vaping crisis and changes in the works. First, 68 schools around the country, including one in Wisconsin, will test out a new advanced placement high school course this fall. For the first time, students will have the opportunity to take a college-level course focused on the African-American experience. While they won't earn college credit during this pilot phase, the coursework will at least appear on their transcript for colleges to see. Our next guest has some insight into what's going to be taught in this course and how it fits into the larger picture of how we teach about race and civil rights in our schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a high school student or a student yourself? What do you think about the idea of an AP-level course focused on African-American history? Would you take it? Do you wish you'd had it when you were in school? What thoughts do you have on how we teach about issues related to African-American history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Robert Smith is the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching and Outreach at Marquette University. He's also resident historian at America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
What was your reaction to this, the initial idea of an AP class in African American history?
Well, you know, I was really excited. I was excited for a couple of reasons. One, it gives us an opportunity at the high school level to really get into and interrogate some really important history that helps to inform some of our understandings of race. But it also takes us back into that rich African past and gives us the opportunity to explore some fundamental questions about the centrality of Africa, its peoples, its cultures, its practices, not only there in the continent, but its imprint and its role in shaping a whole range of cultural and social relationships and ideas across the globe. The conversation about the centrality of Africa begins the course and then helps to frame the rest of the conversation that the course has about the African-American experience.
You've been in touch, I understand, with the College Board, the group that does these AP advanced placement exams on behalf of Marquette University in part. Starting in Africa. Can you give us a sense more of what would be covered in this class?
Well, you know, the class would begin with a conversation of introducing students to what is meant by African-American studies and looking at this through an interdisciplinary lens. So you have multiple disciplines playing a role in shaping that context and that conversation, whether it's history, sociology, political science, geography. And it also plays a significant role in helping students think about the intersections of race, class, and gender, And so it offers that framing and then gets right into a conversation about early African empires, the importance of those kingdoms and those city states and those ethnic communities, and then moves the conversation across the Atlantic and into the Americas. And so students are not only getting a conversation about the African-American experience, it's really a conversation about the African diaspora, how it plays out in other parts of the world, and then how it then locates and emerges here in the U.S. in its own distinctive patterns.
There have been arguments, of course, about how we teach, about the history of race in America, the history of slavery and civil rights. Now, my best classes I remember and the best history books I read, you know, give the facts, sure, and the dates and things like that, but then look at different interpretations and the arguments about how we interpret these things. Is that going to be part of the story here?
Oh, absolutely. You know, part and parcel to the historical examination is this fundamental notion of debate. What do we know about the past? What is the evidence that we use to inform those understandings? And then how do we interpret and how do we consider what we're learning? And that requires a multidisciplinary lens. It requires argument and debate. It requires looking at secondary literature from some of these leading scholars that whose work is a part of the course. It also requires students to think about the role of the arts and also thinking about materials like maps. It plays a significant role in complicating the classroom experience so that students are getting a richer understanding using multiple modes of learning, multiple ideas, multiple sets of materials, so that then those debates and those arguments come alive for those students to develop their own understandings.
Talking to history professor Robert Smith from Marquette University. Our starting point, a new pilot of an advanced placement course in African American studies. It's piloting in schools around the country, including one high school in Milwaukee. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to comment. Back when I was in college, I actually had to fill out, I had to fill out some extra credits for Gen Ed. And one of the courses that I took was a racial diversity course. And it actually turned out to be an eye-opener. And, you know, so much to the point where I thought, I think today that it would actually be in the general teachings of high school students because, when people grow up and become adults, I think the fact that in today's society, whether or not racism actually plays a role in our society is a testament, you know, to the fact that I think the subject is vastly undereducated, Chris, in our system.
Chris, thanks for the call. Robert, Chris says a class he took at college was an eye-opener and wants to see more of it. What do you think?
You know, when students take these courses, whether it's in African-American history, Latinx history, in any of the courses that might fall under the umbrella of ethnic studies, they get exposed to a whole range of ideas, historical trajectories, individuals, movements for equality, and a whole range of other ideas, law and politics. And it gives students an opportunity to explore the same kinds of ideas just through the lenses and experiences of people who've also made up the rich tapestry of this nation's, the heart of the nation's cultural and ethnic diversity. And of course, what we learn over and over is that students love these conversations because they are asking those very difficult questions within themselves and they're looking for answers. And so it's not surprising at all that someone would take these courses or a course like this and then have a very rich academic experience, and then also an experience that helps them think through some of these complicated issues that we grapple with every single day.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Robert Smith from Marquette University is with us. We're talking about a new advanced placement high school course focused on the African-American experience. It is in a pilot stage right now in high schools around the country, including one here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about this new pilot advanced placement course? Do you have a student enrolled in this pilot in Milwaukee? Would you like to see something like this in your school? Do you have thoughts or questions about wider issues of how we teach about race and the history of race in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Robert Smith, professor of history at Marquette University, looking at a new college-level course for high school students focused on the African-American experience. It's in a pilot program right now in high schools around the country, including one in Milwaukee. You could join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert, a lot of scrutiny on schools and how they talk about race. I think a general concern, I guess, or critique that gets expressed at school board meetings and elsewhere from critics is classes like this ultimately end up teaching white kids to feel bad about America's racial history. What do you say to that concern that's been out there, at least in the political sphere?
You know, the first thing I'd like to address is that no one who teaches this is trying to make somebody feel bad. I think that has been mired in the politics of the moment and the politics of our nation's challenges with just talking about race. I think the difficulty with any of these topics is that they do help to expose injustice. They do help to expose long-term historical patterns associated with that injustice or related injustices. And so those are topics that are difficult for all of us to discuss and deal with. But what the reason these courses are important, though, is because it gives us not only that understanding, but a language to understand the challenges, and then therefore gives us a window into how we move forward, because the courses are not simply about the question of mistreatment. The courses are not simply about the historical injustices. These courses also highlight the wonderful achievements of folks who've been a part of the American saga. These courses are also important for giving us an understanding of how basic concepts like citizenship and issues like civil rights were contested, successes that folks in protest communities may have been able to engender. And then also it gives us the opportunity to give our young people an understanding of their role in history and the way that they've played a role in societal change and their obligations to make sure that words like democracy, words like equal protection, words like due process, ideas that are very central to how we understand ourselves as Americans. It gives our young people a window into the importance of them understanding and then living and breathing those principles and those ideals. And so we can't stay mired in this notion that historical tragedies can't be discussed. We have to make sure that we are competent in teaching them and giving our young people the tools to understand them.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marlon is with us in Madison. Marlon, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I was just wondering, I retired from teaching from the Madison Metropolitan School District back 2 years ago. And after school, I coached African-American history teams for each of the middle schools that I worked. And I was just wondering if Milwaukee had something like that. We were able to organize all of the middle schools of Madison, Wisconsin, with the help of 100 black men. So I was wondering, has anyone thought about partnering up with groups like 100 Black Men to be able to accomplish that? And for a time, 100 Black Men was able to come into our schools and mentor students as well.
And I got to ask, Marlon, while you're talking, I looked up. We had a conversation. Was this the African American History Bowl that you ended up participating in?
That's correct.
Yeah, we talked about that on Central Time about 5-ish years ago. Marlon, thanks a lot for calling in. Robert, that kind of after-school program, the competition, what do you think? And do you have anything like that in the Milwaukee area?
You know, I can't speak to any specifically. I'm sure there are any number of opportunities very similar to that. One of the things that's really awesome about folks here in Milwaukee is this real true commitment to providing our young people a whole range of experiences, particularly after school experiences. And these kinds of efforts are particularly important for the shaping of young people's identities as they mature into their teenage years and mature into adulthood. The more of those opportunities that they are able to experience both in school and outside of school, curricular and co-curricular, it just helps to situate the young people as they're maturing and give them the opportunity to not only think about that history, but how they are a part of that historical trajectory and how their local communities have been a part of those conversations. You know, there are rich conversations in and around Milwaukee about its cultural histories and its cultural and racial geographies. Is conversations all the time about our civil rights leadership over the last half century or more. And so I'm sure that there are those kinds of programs around. And I also want to say that we have a number of remarkable teachers that are doing this kind of work in class. And as the gentleman mentioned, as part of after school activities in various ways. And so I applaud our teachers. In fact, Mr. Janky over at Go to My Ear, who's teaching the pilot for AP Afro-American Studies, he's not only teaching that class, but he's the tennis coach as well, you know. And so our teachers deserve a huge, huge shout out for not only helping to educate our young people, but tackling these difficult topics in these courses, because we know it's going to pay off in the end, not only for our young people, but also providing a stellar academic experience. You know, it's not simply the question of the courses being taught. It's also this mastery that teachers bring to addressing and informing and educating about these issues that we have to always herald.
Thanks for that call, Marlon. We just have a minute or so left. Robert, what are you hoping develops out of this AP class just in our last minute?
Well, I think a couple of things would be ideal. One, that this gets adopted widely across the country, that it becomes a part of the rich array of AP courses that are out there, and that it also gives our high school students to start to deal with some of these complicated issues in high school, you know, from a classroom perspective, so that they when they get into our college courses, they're familiar with some of these topics. In the college classroom, we can amplify and build on some of these ideas. And so if we are able to then get more and more schools buying into AP Afro-American Studies, it's just going to supplement, complement, enliven the AP curriculum all the more. And then also, as students transition to college, they're going to come already having an understanding of some of these really complicated ideas, and also know which historical documents to turn to, which literary texts to turn to, which art and historical historically rich and vibrant art and material culture, where to turn to those to learn a little bit more. So the horizon is just rich and replete with all kinds of opportunities here.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
That's Robert Smith, the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching and Outreach at Marquette University. He joins us today for a look at the new AP course for African American Studies being piloted this school year, including at one high school in Milwaukee. Now, some Wisconsin farmers are cultivating a new crop, energy. Around the state, developers are partnering with rural landowners to build 100-acre solar farms. As WPR contributor Jana Rose Schleiss reports, it's a trend that's likely to continue.
Ken Duvenek was a dairy farmer for all of his life. By 2007, he was 60 years old, and his health made it difficult to continue.
My knees were gone. I had one knee replaced, and it was just get to the point where I couldn't hardly do it no more. I know the kids, my sons, they weren't going to milk no more, and now it just gotten to the point where I just couldn't do it no more, you know.
Duvenek tried other ways to earn farm income.
And I kept raising heifers after that. I bought them and sold them. And then that went good for a while. But then that market went out.
Then in 2018, like his neighbors, Duvenek and his wife Rita signed a 30-year contract to lease their land for solar energy generation. Now, past the red barns of the Duvenek farm in the tiny town of Two Creeks, 40 acres of solar panels rotate towards the sun. Duvenek said the solar contract is an opportunity to keep the land and the farm in his family. Ken's wife, Rita, said it was a hard decision to temporarily give up the land on their fourth-generation farm, but she's glad the solar panels allow them to cultivate a different kind of crop.
You know, so what? We farm the sun. So...
Consumer demand for renewable energy is growing. Developers are partnering with farmers to meet those demands. Farmers have what solar energy companies need, land. Hosting solar panels allows dairy farmers to diversify their income in a market that can sometimes be unpredictable. Brent Sinkula is the president of the Manitowoc County Farm Bureau. He says the changing market has made it difficult for smaller farms to survive.
It's that middle that seems to be kind of falling out. And that's where I am.
In 2018, the company NextEra Energy asked Sinkula if he would rent 500 acres of his farm for solar panels. It meant giving up a third of his land, but gaining an extra income.
It was an easy decision, no, but you know, after my parents and I talking it over and discussing, we decided, you know, it'd be nice to have something to fall back on.
Now the cows on Irish Acres Dairy graze right next to rows and rows of glistening photovoltaic panels absorbing the sun's rays. Two Creeks is a lakeshore community nestled between Manitowoc and Door County. NextEra Energy has developed two large-scale solar farms here, spanning over 1,200 acres. The town has a long history with the energy industry. Since the 1970s, Two Creeks has been home to the Point Beach nuclear plant. James Tingem researches renewable energy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says there are three things that make a community an ideal location to develop energy facilities: transmission capacity, willing landowners, and a power purchase agreement.
You got those three things, you've got a project.
Tingem said existing infrastructure, like transmission lines to move the energy, is a big reason why energy companies are attracted to places like Two Creeks. The town and the county receive utility tax payments for hosting the energy facilities. Town Chairman Lee Engelbrecht hopes the additional money from the solar farms can be used to help maintain roads.
I think it's good for the town, it's good for the county, and we need energy. Everybody wants to go to that light switch and expects it to go on when they flip it on.
NextEra plans to expand its renewable energy developments in Wisconsin to the tune of $2 billion. Sinkula and Duvenek both say they've gotten calls from other farmers who want to know whether farming the sun might work for them. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jana Rose Schleiss.
Jana Rose Schleiss is a Pulitzer Center reporting fellow from the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Coming up after the news, e-cigarette company Juul has agreed to pay more than $400 million in a settlement after a two-year investigation into the company's marketing toward teenage users. We'll find out what led to the settlement and look at the impact of vaping on teens. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.